You're listening to The Watchers, a show where two women from opposite ends of New Jersey watch TV and movies about various ways that civilization can end. There's some main ones, right?
Yeah.
Nuclear war, superbug. What else? Capitalism. The real evil.
You know, rising ocean temperatures.
Yes. Exactly.
Good thing none of these are horrors that we live in every single day, huh?
Exactly. It's nice to watch TV that has no relationship whatsoever to our current situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We watched Fallout.
Yeah, and you're Jody.
And I am. I'm Jody, and you're Andrea.
I am, in fact.
And neither of us had seen this, and so this is sort of a nice little departure where it's not something either of us is already attached to.
Yeah, and I will say going into it, I think I had more familiarity with the universe than you, but I think we're gonna learn pretty quickly that that's no longer with the greater Fallout universe than you, but
yeah.
We're gonna learn pretty quickly that is maybe no longer the case.
No, I fell into a big old rabbit hole last night about the general expansive world of Fallout. I think we should start maybe with our relationship individually to like video games, this kind of thing, the idea of the adaptation of a video game as a TV show, like a little bit of background.
Yeah. And then I think that's important. And then I also think when we get into actually reviewing the show, we're going to try to keep it contained to the, once we get the sort of scene setting set and that greater conversation talking about the pilot as a pilot, I want to try to apply our general criteria and treat it as contained as possible, keeping in mind all of the extra stuff. This is a little complicated.
This is Andrea's warning to me to not spend the entire time talking about Fallout 76 and the New Jersey Atlantic City expedition. Because that is all I want to talk about. And it has nothing to do with this pilot.
I think we can do both.
Yes.
It's going to be great.
I think
in general. I don't know that either one of us would consider ourselves avid gamers.
Definitely not.
It's not like part of my identity pie, though.
Nope.
As I've said to you, I do like two or three games a year get deeply, deeply into.
You are definitely more of a gamer than I am. I have not played an actual video game on my own other than stupid phone games since I was a teenager, probably.
Yeah. For me, it's a time and attention thing. Like, I wish that I had the time and attention to play more because I do really love what, like, stories can be told. And I just, like, anytime a Zelda game comes out, you're just not going to hear from me for a few weeks.
Right. I do remember that happening.
Exactly. Anytime a Persona game comes out, you're not going to hear from me for a few weeks. And then I always have a handful of games that I'm sort of playing while I'm doing, like, QA listens to podcasts or, like, listening through episodes for clips and stuff. And those are always on rotation right now. I'm saying right now. This game is years old and the sequel is out now. But Hades is an incredible game. I don't know why I'm giving game recommendations. We don't need to do that right now. But point being, this is what I was actually getting at. In the same way that I don't play D&D, but I listen to and watch a lot of D&D podcasts and shows.
It's a fact about you that I cannot get over.
I spend more time listening to...
I know you're not alone in this, but it's such a part of the world I wasn't aware of.
But if you're a fan of listening to people build stories together,
yeah.
Like some of them are so good. Like I cry
can see
sometimes.
It now. Yeah.
It's yeah. And that's how I feel
not,
about this too.
That's normal though.
Yeah.
You cry at
and
everything.
That's fair.
You'll probably cry at least once during this podcast.
That's also true. But I listen to some video game based podcasts and I watch a lot of like Let's Plays and stuff like that with video games. So I'm kind of like on the edge of this universe
right.
of video games in general a little bit more. And I have a pretty like surface level but wide ranging understanding of the video game landscape right now.
Yeah. I think the last time I was like actually even peripherally engaged with a video game was like watching my friends play Myst. In the 90s.
Well, Jody,
late 90s.
I've got news for you. You can play it now, right now on Switch. I have it downloaded. That's another
I'm
game
sure
I will just...
I'm sure you can. I never played it myself in the first place. It was what, like, my friends were doing while we were all hanging out.
Myst might be the reason I'm the way... Myst walked so lost could run and then maybe fall down. Like, that's the first game where I was looking up, like, cheat, like, not cheat codes, but, like, walkthroughs online. And I didn't have a printer, so I would have to write, handwrite everything down and then go back to the game. Because, like, I was deeply invested.
Yeah, a couple of my friends would play that. And then also Castle Wolfenstein. So
different vibe, for sure.
Different vibe, but yes. Those were my... later in life. I mean, I was an early video game adoptee. It just didn't continue. I played a ton of video games obsessively when I was a kid. I had all of the different consoles.
Same. Like, my brother is 10 years. My brother is 10 years older than me, and he was obsessed. He was like, so I played everything.
Yeah.
As a young person, we were at Blockbuster when they started having video games, like, several times a week. Like, we were a big, big video game playing family.
I mean, I need
everyone to know I'm going to be about 15% more distracted than usual because all I'm thinking about is playing Myst now. I will try to bring us back.
So, okay. So that's our relationship to video games, or lack thereof, on my side. This show, one of the things that it's being compared to a lot right now is Last of Us, which came out, what, a year or two ago? And I have been talking about with you as a possible watch option, but we haven't decided to do it because we've been doing pilots, and the pilot of The Last of Us is not the, quote, most significant episode, at least not to me. You know, I'm one of those people that lost their minds sobbing at episode 3, and the rest of it's just kind of like a post-apocalyptic romp, you know, but a very dark one. We'll talk about the tone in this, I'm sure, and how specific it is. But so it's being compared to Last of Us because they're both to kind of the first two widely successful adaptations of video games that are on TV, at least recently.
Well, on TV, but even talking about, I mean, I would say definitely on TV, but even if we want to bring movies in, there are some that have been commercial successes. Like, I think the Resident Evil series, some of those movies have done really well, and Silent Hill. But to have ones that are commercially and critically well received, I mean, like, I'm just looking at the list because I could only think, the only ones I could think of were that terrible Final Fantasy movie. But it's like, there's that Super Mario Brothers movie from the 90s that is notorious for being terrible. I'm just going to read through a list of the kinds of movies, the kinds of video games that got adaptations for a long time. And so this is starting in 93. There's the Super Mario Brothers movie, Double Dragon, Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat got a few, Tomb Raider, again, Resident Evil, those movies have done okay. I'm going to
Tomb Raider, isn't that Angelina Jolie?
Yeah, yep.
In that outfit? Yeah, okay. Yep, correct. I'm familiar.
But again, I don't think a critical success, certainly. I could be wrong.
The only thing I know about that movie is Angelina Jolie in the outfit.
Yeah, I think that's true for many of us. And then there have been others, but it's like, you know, there's the Prince of Persia movie with Jake Gyllenhaal. It's just like, oh, and then if you get, like, there's the Pokemon Detective Pikachu movie. The Sonic movie. And so it's like you either get ones that are going to be a draw for kids, or just like really like kind of like gratuitous, kind of, I don't know if vapid's the right word, but action movies, right?
Yeah. Although famously, Nicole Byer is a huge fan of the Sonic movies.
She makes me cry when she talks about it.
She's so emotional about them.
Well, and it's because she's like, oh, I could really cry. She's like, because it's about. To her, as somebody, I think I've said this on the podcast, she's the reason I was like, oh, I think I should probably talk to somebody about having ADHD.
Yeah.
Because she's like, because he goes too fast and all he wants are friends, but it's really hard for him to connect with people. And like, really. Have you seen the clip of Ben Schwartz talking to her as Sonic on stage?
I have.
I cried 3 times during the first one. And then I was at home, and then I just started it over again and watched it for a second time immediately. And then the second one, I dragged a friend with me, and I cried during that one, too. I cried twice.
Do you remember what moment made you cry?
No, I have ADHD.
Shardy said that.
I just like grabbed the big
I would love to talk crying. To Sonic to you. Go, turn around. God, I hope that you cry in real time. All right, ready.
Okay, Sonic, how did it feel when you finally got a friend?
First of all, Nicole, I wanted to say hi, okay? I think you're so cool. I love your heart. You're a heart-forward person, and I understand it. I get it. I mean, listen, I came to this world all by myself, and I didn't have anybody to hang out with. And I keep moving fast, and I keep wanting to do things all the time. My brain and my body wants to go so fast, just like yours. But this is what happened. When I finally found my friend in Tom, in the Donut Lord, I felt like I could just be myself and share myself and show my failures and show my triumphs, and I finally had someone to be with.
I loved it. I really wish I turned around and magically you were wearing a costume.
And that was it.
You're like, I'm here!
That rolled.
Oh, it's so good. I'll link to that in the show notes. It makes me so happy.
Oh, it is good. Yeah. But, okay, so Sonic aside, and it's a genius, obviously.
Right.
This is sort of a new phenomenon in the last couple of years where very popular video games with very rabid fan bases are actually being adapted into successful TV shows. And I mean, it's a group of two right now, but
that's a pretty, you know,
but I mean, in the time frame, especially, I think that, you know, some of the things that maybe allowed that to happen for Last of Us and for Fallout are the directors that they worked with, but also the way they were adapted and the way that the people involved either stuck to or didn't the framework that they were given. Like, I think in both cases, they found really unique and clever ways to work within the world, but not be totally beholden.
Well, and I think
to every
part
detail.
Of that, and this is what is, I mean, new in the full timeline of video games, is having these huge open world games where you can, mm-hmm. there's just so much, you know, that you can kind of like focus in on one specific. And I think from what I know about Last of Us, it's sort of like shining a magnifying glass on different areas, right? Each episode of like.
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of Last of Us is, from what I have read about it, which I haven't done the deep dive into it because we haven't done it, but I watched the whole series, is that it sticks pretty closely actually to, I think, the first game or the first part of it. But it allows expansion into stories that were smaller moments in the original game.
Okay, gotcha.
That are allowed, like the episode 3 with Bill and Frank, like, they exist in the game.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
But it's not, they're not, their personal story, I guess, isn't elaborated on as much. So, like, part of the thing with Last of Us, and we're not here to talk about this show, but part of the thing with Last of Us that is apparently a little tricky going forward is that in the game, some people don't exist past a certain point. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of at this departure where they have to decide how closely they're going to stick to the story of the game and how far they're going to kind of go past that.
Interesting.
And so I think the smart thing that they did with Fallout seems to be that it's a story that exists in the world of the game. And there are cameos and not just cameos, like actual characters from the game that show up. But it's not, it takes place past the timeline of anything that's happened in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a new story within an existing world.
Right.
And according to the creators of the game, there's all this like, is this canon? Is this canon? Is this canon in fucking everything?
Mm-hmm.
But according to the creators of the game, this is canon. This is almost like an extension of the game.
Okay, cool.
Which is kind of cool.
Yeah, like, I like that.
They gave themselves a really big window for creativity within the world that they'd already created,
mm-hmm.
which I think is really smart.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should just start with how we felt about it. Because we were texting a little bit while you started watching it. And then I was like, oh yeah, I want to watch this. And so I put it on. And so you were a little bit ahead of me in watching it. But how did you feel about it?
I loved it. I was trying in trying to watch it separate from knowing anything about the video games, I was at first a little put off by how violent it is.
Yeah, it's pretty violent.
It's pretty horrifically violent.
Yeah.
And if you... And but knowing that, like, I think compared to what the video games are, just having seen what I've seen, it's definitely not over. It's not like you thought the video games were. Well, wait till you watch Fallout, you know? It's pretty in line, or maybe even a little tamer than what I've seen in the video games.
Hmm.
So once I kind of settled into that, then I just had a really good time with it. I thought I don't want to get into specifics yet. The two things I had to do were let go of being put off by the gore and violence of it. And I'm not very squeamish in general. It just is, you know, it's the older I get, the harder it does get for me.
We
talked about this, I think just last week, maybe, recently it was The Sopranos. That gets harder for me, but once I settled, you know, I squared myself with that. And then the other thing was like remembering that this is a pilot and that they were introducing these different things thoughtfully, knowing that not everybody had played the game. So if there was something where I was like, wait, I'm a little confused, it would take me about 15 seconds longer to get up to speed with what I was watching, as opposed to being like, oh, they think I'm supposed to know what this is because, and it's no, this is just new. So it's going to be new for me.
Yeah, there's a little bit of, I think, a higher level of difficulty in something like this, because you have a big chunk of your audience that is watching it knowing so much about this world that it's like they're looking for certain things.
Right.
They're not sitting back and like accepting whatever story is given to them. They're checking it against what they already know. And then there's a whole other group of people like us, or like me in particular, who knew nothing at all about the game and just went in totally blind. And you have to satisfy both of those groups to make it successful.
And then again, me, who I think falls somewhere in the middle, which is maybe why I did struggle a little bit with that. It's like, probably if you knew nothing or everything, you'd be, because for me, I didn't realize until reading up on it after that, like, Lucy doesn't exist in the games. Those vaults are brand new.
The vaults exist.
Well, the idea of vaults, but those specific numbered vaults.
Gotcha. Yes, exactly.
They're brand new. Nobody's been inside those vaults before.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah.
And so I think that's really smart. And if you're somebody who is a fan of the video games, you're going to know that right away, that this is brand new. And if you're someone who knows nothing, you're going to have nothing to compare it to. So I think maybe for me, that's where the struggle was, but I was over it pretty much
right away. I don't think that was entirely just you. I think this is a long pilot. This was over an hour. It was like almost 75 minutes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they covered a lot.
Yeah. Impressively so.
Like, but I will say that I think what you're saying about taking a few minutes to figure out each new scene is partly due to the fact that they're trying to introduce so much in this first episode that it did feel a little bit like whiplash occasionally. It was like, okay, now we're here. Wait, okay. Wait, why are we in a cemetery? Wait, what's going on? What the fuck? Like, you know, the jumping around, they tried to organize it by the title cards and things like that, and to make it feel a little bit more that they knew what they were doing in showing us these different places, that everything's going to come together. This is going to all interact.
Take some faith in the show creators as you're watching.
Right. But I did feel that sense of being a little unmoored a couple of times when I would be dropped into a new location and be like, okay, wait, what is happening? How does this connect?
That was especially true for me with Maximus's setting. Cause I was like, wait, are they on the surface? I thought we can't. Okay, so we can, but, and is this a secure, why aren't they worried about raiders? all of that, figuring out. And now as I'm getting ready to say this out loud, I'm wondering if this is maybe part of it where I'm like, is this, of course it is. What am I even? A show where you're like, okay, but who are the real, they seem like the good guys, right? This is our I've put myself in the vault, so I'm somebody in the vault. And this is our military who's up top getting ready to, you know, recolonize.
See, I had a totally different take on it.
But my question then being is, are we are we going to find out that they're not, you know, really
Yeah.
And is nobody on anybody's side? And we're all these like, war, you know.
Warring factions.
It's interesting. Yeah.
I mean, for me, like the one that started to take me out a little bit that I had to really pull myself back into was the graveyard, was the ghoul of it all, was Walton Goggins, his second appearance, who I love. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love Walton Goggins. He's such an amazing, like, charismatic presence.
Perfectly named.
Yeah, perfectly named. But everything up until that point felt so grounded in, like, a human experience, even though it's wildly, like, fantastical, mm-hmm. that once you get to, like, somebody partially alive underground in a... I was like, okay, we're going full off the grid here. Like,
well, that says a lot, too, about how... quite literally insulated the folks in the vaults are, that it feels so different that when we get to that, you know, their experience has been so kind of protected. They're living a pretty neat little life in the beginning.
Yeah, very Silo, but like light.
Very, yeah, I forgot you did watch Silo, right?
I did watch Silo. Yeah. Yeah. Silo, but colorful.
And
happy.
That's okay. When are we
it's
getting
like the anti-silo?
I can't wait to talk world building. I'm so excited to talk about all of that and the aesthetics and all. I think they're so cool.
I could talk about the color grading differences when they get above ground, like, all day. Well, since you asked, I liked it too. People who know me casually might be surprised to know that I actually kind of enjoy this type of television sometimes. Like, mm-hmm. I did watch all of The Last of Us, even mm-hmm. though, like, do I care about a fungus taking over mankind? Not really, but like there's something in the 19-year-old part of me climbing around abandoned mental hospitals
totally.
That is just in love with this type of landscape. Mm-hmm. I think there's the photographer part of me, there's like the part of me that like tried to find the broken down cages of jungle habitat, which was like a ill-fated zoo and safari park in northern New Jersey, mm-hmm. That did a lot of that type of exploring, that found the old Nike missile base in Mahwah when I was a teenager. So like, it's more for me about the landscape. You know, I'm not a huge supernatural, like sci-fi, fantasy, whatever. Like the ghoul thing, that to me, of course, is the thing that took me out of it, right? Because I'm like, whatever. It's, I don't care.
I love doing this show with you because that's like, I liked so much of everything, but that scene was when I was like, oh, I guess I'm just going to keep watching this show.
And for me, it was like when she came out and saw what was supposed to be probably Santa Monica Pier, because mm-hmm. this is LA, I think, that mm-hmm. they're based in for this, in the show, not in real life, mm-hmm. Where I was like, oh, post-civilization views of, contemporary cities where there are things I can recognize, but it's nature has taken it back, or you know, it's been obliterated in some way. Like, that's to me, I'm like, yeah, I'm climbing around an abandoned mental hospital, like, you know, finding old Bibles on the floor. Mm-hmm. Like, it's there's just that part of me is what gets excited about shows like this. Like in Last of Us as well, there's like scenes where they're, you know, there's famously a scene where they're in where I think what was an old zoo and there's just a giraffe still there,
just like hanging out.
Just hanging out. And so that to me is what I enjoy about these types of shows. So we talked about this last night a little bit. I probably will keep watching it mm-hmm. and I will probably watch it to the end. I have to finish 6 Feet Under first, but right.
Obviously you've got priorities.
I'm on season 5 already. I'm on the last season. My ADHD. I have to make this comment real quick while we're talking about 6 Feet Under because mm-hmm. I'm not going to get a chance to later. I had the wildest conversation with my best friend about that show last night. I texted her and was like, were you a 6 Feet Under person, right? Because one of our first bonding experiences was we liked all the same movies and TV shows. Right. And she was like, yeah, but I never watched the finale. And I was like,
isn't that the thing?
Excuse me? The most well-regarded and loved finale of all time that I mm-hmm. sobbed through. And she was like, yeah, exactly. She was like, I just wanted to let it end in my head. And mm-hmm. I was like, that is the wildest thing you've ever said to me. Because I'm like already anticipating watching the finale of that show mm-hmm. and what it's going to do to me now that mm-hmm. I've reinvested in all these characters. That's so strange. Anyway, So no, but I will probably keep watching this. I mean, I watched all of Last of Us. I watched all of Silo. Like, I just kind of, I'm okay with living in those worlds, mm-hmm. you know, and just seeing, I mean, we're going to talk later on about Station 11, same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Seeing Chicago, like, post-apocalypse is, it's just interesting to me as a visual person, as a visual artist.
Yeah, and Fallout is especially interesting, and maybe we're in the sort of, I don't know, this is like setting world building stuff.
Yeah.
But they've got two things going, which is that like retro futuristic, mm-hmm. what if the 1950s
yeah.
kind of like view of the future really played out.
Yep.
And then what if 127, because I think it's 2077, right? Years later, the world basically ends.
Yeah, 200
years
later, approximately. Yeah.
Well, it's the, I think the bomb drops in 2077.
Oh, right. It's when they come out of the, and or when they're in the
get,
vault.
Yeah. So we get that those two little wrinkles in our real world, and yeah. then we do a time jump, which I think is really cool. I really love that these stories that are focusing more on like, yeah, we've spent a lot of time dealing with the immediate fallout of nuclear war in our stories, but what happens on the other side of it? And I think that's, you get to see all of that sort of happen when Lucy emerges from the vault. And that's very
cool. And you also see what would happen to people that grew up not knowing anything else. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's generations now. Mm-hmm. It's like hundreds of years later, none of these people have lived outside. Mm-hmm. Not their parents, not like, you know, it's not like it just happened.
Yeah.
So, and I think that that's something that when we talk about Station 11 is also interesting, because you have the immediate aftermath and you also have much later, like when this has, the new society or whatever it is, has been established for a while and it's sort cool. of the new normal kind of.
It is really fun to hold this one up against Silo. I'm glad you brought it up because Silo is bleak. Silo is bleak no matter what level you're at. Even the like where there are those scenes where they're like at those like the cornfields too and the mm-hmm. orchards, and even that feels dark and
definitely.
And like Fallout is so kind of those that the vaults that we see, or at least Lucy's vault, is so vibrant in a lot mm-hmm. of ways, and like people seem to be having a pretty good time for the most part.
Yeah.
Like, and I know that it's hiding the same kind of darkness underneath that Silo is, but it's like you could, like, Lucy wasn't having a bad time until.
Yeah. It definitely has to do, I think, with the sort of 1950s suburban vibe that continued mm-hmm. in that specific vault, where it's like they're.
Which is funny, though, because one of the things they both do that. I don't know if we talked about this on mic when we were sort of recommending, deciding whether or not to recommend Silo, because I know I've gone back and forth, is they both do the thing that everybody loves, which is the mid-century modern, that retro-futuristic. We're all obsessed with that look for some reason.
But so, in Silo, that look looks aged.
Exact. Yes,
and
exactly.
In this, it looks bright and colorful, mm-hmm. and it looks... So I mentioned this to you when we were texting about the show, but... And not to bring my art into this or whatever, but I've done
How
a lot of
dare you.
No, but I've done a lot of research on the graphics of the post mm-hmm. of the Cold War and like nuclear arms race time, mm-hmm. right? And it is so wildly cartoonish.
Right.
And strangely cheerful.
Right. So like this like, didn't feel unrealistic or like.
No, this is based on, this is what it on is. The graphics of the time. Like,
it's incredible.
There's that whole duck and cover film. Do you remember seeing that with the turtle?
Oh, Bert the Turtle? Look at him.
Deedle-dum-dum. There was a turtle by the name of Bert. And Bert the Turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He'd duck and cover, duck and cover.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You and you
and you
and you. Duck and cover.
It is like so cheerful.
The thing about Fallout and the thing about this and all of it is that if when you watch this video, folks, please go do, because it was delightful in a horrifying way. It all feels very recognizable. Like, it's not, it doesn't feel unrealistic. And it is like, huh, the scene in the very beginning that takes place in 2077, which we should get into a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the way they're having that birthday party while the news is in the background.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. That's what I mean when I was
tough.
Like, yeah, it's a good
tough.
Thing. It's a good thing that none of this is close to our reality. Like, good God. Yeah. So. The photographer in me was like, that camera that he's using, I own that. I have one of those. It's like one of the Art Deco brownies. But yeah, so that sort of 1950s overly cheery while the world ends thing is not just made up for effect in the show.
Right.
It's just emphasized and then continued into the setting of the vault.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're trying to keep to our sort of pilot framework, which I'm notoriously bad at, the things that we kind of want to look at and compare across the various pilots are world building. So like set and setting, the questions that it brings up. What's the other one?
The hook.
The hook. Yes, that's it.
The hook brings you back.
The hook does bring you back. Nice. Maybe we could give a quick recap of the episode, like literally just like I have literally the paragraph from Wikipedia just to give people a framework for what the, in case they didn't see it or they haven't watched it yet. So I'm just going to read that real quick to give us a little bit of a place setting. So it says, in 2077, actor Cooper Howard and his daughter Janie are caught in the middle of a nuclear attack against Los Angeles. 219 years later, Vault 33 dweller Lucy McLean, McLean volunteers for an arranged marriage with a dweller from Vault 32, which is connected to 33 along with Vault 31. After the wedding, the Vault 32 visitors, who were greasy and dirty and they should have fucking known they weren't okay.
So funny.
His hair was too greasy.
They didn't trust us to automatically assume something was off unless they smudged him up like high school theater.
Exactly. After the wedding, the Vault 32 visitors are revealed to be raiders led by Lee Moldaver, I can't pronounce that right. Lucy's father and overseer of Vault 33, Hank McLean, is forced to leave with them. In defiance of Vault regulations, Lucy decides to go to the surface by herself to search for her father. Meanwhile, Brotherhood of Steel aspirant Maximus is promoted to the rank of squire and joins Knight Titus in hunting for a member of the Enclave. This is what I mean where I was like, there's a lot going on here, guys. Yeah. Can we try to organize ourselves? Elsewhere, several bounty hunters locate Howard, who has been transformed by radiation into a ghoul, and attempt to recruit him to find the same Enclave member. Instead, Howard kills them all and pursues the bounty alone. So, and when we think about that description, the places that we're introduced to, because if we're going to talk set and setting,
totally,
the places are pre-war Los Angeles, the Vault, the Brotherhood of Steel, like
compound,
training ground,
whatever,
compound. Wherever the fuck the ghoul was buried with like weird IV bags attached. And just outside the vault, we see what Lucy sees, which is like the wasteland of Los Angeles. But there's also a lot more of those locations, like really detailed ones coming, but that's kind of what we're introduced to start off.
Yeah. My first note is they only named him Cooper Howard because Walton Goggins was taken.
Yes.
That's a Walton Goggins right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Cooper Howard, Walton Goggins. Mm-hmm. Perfect. So yeah, if we start with the hook, I mean, you want to take this one?
I mean, it's what, it's like what happens when the world ends, but keeps going, you know, like,
which is the hook for most of these post-apocalyptic shows. Like, how do people cope both physically, specifically, like how do you survive whatever has happened? So like in the case of Station 11, it's like, how do you not get killed by this like super bug or whatever? Last of Us, how do you avoid the crazy monsters, the fungus virus thing? I'm not describing that well, but, and in this, it's like, how do you survive the immediate radiation and then the ground and the land being irradiated, and how do you find food and all that stuff, and how do you survive humanity?
It's such a, man, the fallout, the thing that is especially unique for Fallout is it's not even just, well, we're 200 years in and we've kind of figured out what our day-to-day life is going to be. It's, we're almost ready to reemerge.
Yeah.
They said next, the next generation will be,
right,
levels will be low enough, as opposed to something like Silo, where they're not even thinking about reemerging.
But so in Silo, you're forbidden to have, like, technology from before, right? And I think technology from before is important in Fallout. And I know a little bit more about this than I probably should because I've read ahead, but in a different way.
Well, they're not afraid. They're not afraid of it at all. Like,
no.
We see, and this is one of the things I know because I keep deciding how much to. There's a YouTube series that I love called Monster Factory. And it's two of the brothers from My Brother and Me will play the beginning of a video game. They'll create just the most fucked up character they can and then do like tell a little story in the world. And so I've watched their series where they do, it's like probably over an hour of gameplay of them in the Fallout universe. So I know Mr. Handy the robot, you see him in the very, very beginning before the world gets blown up. So that's like one of your big hints that they're, technology is a little more advanced than you think it would be for this kind of setting.
Yeah.
But then, like, when Monty reveals himself to be a raider, Lucy has that, her, like, bracer that reads radiation levels and stuff. And when they approve her to go to trade, she gets the approval on her.
Yeah.
Is bracer the right word? On her bracer.
It's referred to something specific, referred to as something specific in that world, but I can't remember what it is. Apologies.
So I like that they're not, that in comparison, in juxtaposition to Silo, that we're like, oh, they didn't just like put quite the pause on it. They're forced to put a pause on it because there's not a whole lot of like innovation that can happen, but they're not afraid of.
No, and it's interesting, I think, as we, it seems like, both continue to watch, the technology in this show, I mean, this is an alternate United States, right, where things didn't progress the way they do here, but they did end in nuclear annihilation. And so the technology is, like, related to technology that we have, but it's not always, like, following the trajectory of the way we know our technology went. And so, like, there's a lot with, like, the Tesla coil and all sorts of, like, you know.
It's so, like, fun that they did this, though, because the thing that is so, like, and it's, like, kind of quirky, is it's not that 1950s technology bomb drops in 1956, so they're stuck.
Right.
It's 1950s, but we stayed on that specific trajectory.
Yeah.
And just did that again, like I said, for over 100 years. So it gives us, it's like a really fun play on that, which I'm such a sucker for, and I know I've said it 12 times now, but that retro future aesthetic and stuff of, like, I just think it's so fun.
Yeah. I know we want to stick to what we learn in the pilot, but I do, since we're talking about this, I think it is interesting to know exactly what they're trying to do with this. So just to read quickly from this article about the game and the storytelling in it. It says, the series is set in a fictionalized United States in an alternate history scenario that diverges from reality after 1945, following World War II.
Right.
In this alternative atom punk golden age, vacuum tubes and atomic physics serve as the foundations of scientific progress, while transistors are not as scientifically important in this world. As such, a bizarre socio-technological status quo emerges in which advanced robots, nuclear-powered cars, directed energy weapons, and other futuristic technologies are seen alongside 1950s-era computers and television.
That's so fun.
Yeah. So it's this, like, this moment in time where the specific choices of technologies to develop
and follow.
It's
like a very what-if. It's not like, well, this couldn't have been our future. It absolutely could have.
And it's like why their TVs are like still look like they're from the 60s, but they have these other like weirdly advanced things that we can't imagine having.
That's so fun.
Yeah. It's very cool.
Yeah.
The whole backstory is super interesting. I know that's not what we're going to necessarily get into, but it really, it's an alternative world that I think is interesting because of its connections to our reality.
Mm-hmm.
Resource wars, energy, mm-hmm. oil, all of the stuff that we, you know, talked about, how close it feels.
Well, and this is not anything new for a podcast or in general what I'm about to say, but it's like all of these are ways for us to play out our own anxieties about our world in a setting that is just removed enough that it feels safe, you know?
Right. Mildly safe.
Mildly. That gap gets smaller and smaller every fucking day.
I know. So, I mean, we're already kind of into world building mm-hmm. and set and setting, but we have a few different worlds
mm-hmm.
that are built. You know, we have the pre-war world, which is 2077. So it's like the future, but it feels like the past because everything is in that atomic age, brightly colored vibe. They're still using Brownie cameras in 2077 with the little pop flash. And mm-hmm. It took me a minute to realize that it was not still the 60s or the 50s in that moment.
It feels, that's what's a little, it's one of the things that makes this so like unsettling, but in a really delightful way, is that there's a version of this where that is 1955 or whatever, and it's only been 10 years, but nuclear, you know what I mean?
Like, yes.
But because they let it progress, then we do get those, there's just that really fun, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, so I think the first setting that we're introduced to is one that doesn't last very long. You know, the title card says the end.
Yeah.
Before we even get to it.
Mm-hmm.
But then, so then we end up in the vault
mm-hmm.
and we meet Lucy
mm-hmm.
talking about how her reproductive organs are intact.
Jackie,
which is very important.
We have to just a little bit. We haven't even mentioned.
I know.
That was my biggest reason for being like, we kind of have to do it. We can't.
Yeah.
Jackie's got a new, Ella Purnell has a new show, and we have to talk about it.
And she's different in this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and obviously it's character, but like sometimes people like her get typecast.
Right.
And she does have that sort of like quirky, popular, everyone loves me.
She's such a big-eyed, fresh-faced actor that it's so, what's fun about her is, and they do it differently here, but you let that be the thing on the surface. And then Jackie has the like meanness and the kind of like fragility underneath, as opposed to Lucy, who is, she's like by the books. I don't get the impression that like that perkiness, like Lucy is clearly a badass from the beginning. They make that clear. She's not like a babied girl because her dad is the overseer.
Right.
She just is like, she's like the ideal citizen, but for real, you know?
Yeah. But it's interesting that like some misogynistic things have been saved and kept from mm-hmm. the before times, right? She's basically being sold off into marriage.
Right. So she wants to go.
She does. Yes. I know. But
we are all
know,
complicit in our own place in the patriarchy. So
exactly. But it's like for the betterment of the species, mm-hmm. reproduction, blah, 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 a little bit of a Handmaid's Tale vibes, but also not cheerful Handmaid's Tale. I don't know.
Yeah. It's interesting because it doesn't feel like her dad is pushing her. It feels like it is a thing that she really wants to do. And again,
betterment of this, of the world. Yeah.
But there's a different version of this where she's kind of dragged into it and that's part of the conflict, but that's not what's going on.
No, she cares about repopulating America and she doesn't want to do it with her cousin.
The matter of factness of that stuff is so
cousin
funny.
Stuff.
Oh my God.
That really cracked me up.
Yeah. It's really good.
Yeah.
The taboos that we sort of let go of, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're stuck with the same group of people, one of them's your cousin, mm-hmm. but you got to fool around with someone, like, right. I guess.
Yeah.
But
it's also, well, the thing too is that which is sort of smart is that then we don't have to feel, I mean, the thing with Monty is bad, but it doesn't feel like, oh, she's been waiting. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Oh, well, that's what I was going to say. Wait, I lost track of my train of thought.
Go ahead.
I had a thought that I was going to complete. So we do keep some of the misogynistic stuff from our time. But she's sort of nonchalantly like a pipe fitter, and she's good with weapons, and she seems to be very independent, and her father seems to respect that about her. And like, so we've kept some of the older traditions, some of the more negative older traditions, but there's also ways that it seems like some of that stuff has just kind of fallen away and hasn't, you know, been useful, I guess.
Right.
In this new world. Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Like, you know, somebody's got to be a pipe fitter.
Right. Might as well be Lucy.
Yeah. But at the same time, she's putting on a white dress that a bunch of women have signed to go meet her new betrothed. Yeah.
Just that there are some things they do aesthetically that are a little cheap. And one of them is her running around fighting in that
wedding
dress.
With no shoes on.
Yeah. Where it's just like, we know it looks cool. We know it's impractical.
She's shoeless for way too long. It really bothered me.
I agree. But we wanted a scene of Lucy running around barefoot in a wedding dress with a gun or a giant knife.
Yeah.
So we're just going to let that's just going to happen.
Yeah. So the vault is our first main, outside of that quick initial Los Angeles 2077 bit, our first main setting. And I think the connection to Silo is obvious, right? It's like a big round space with projections on the walls of the quote unquote outside world.
But it's not a secret. That's one of the things I like is that there doesn't seem to be a lot of like nefarious behind the scenes stuff going on there. Right. It's all above ground.
We do have the sort of dichotomy though between the prettiness of what they've created, like the screens and the like changing it to sunset and the little twinkle lights and the tables, and it still feels like a little fake and sad because we know, but at the same time the vibe is quite different in Silo. Everything is like dirty and grimy, and like if there's a veneer of cleanliness and prettiness, it's very thin. And here the dirtiness of like the tunnels between the vaults and stuff like that is not, it's not everywhere.
Yeah.
It's like there's the nice part and then there's the like practical technical connections between things.
Yeah. And it makes it all the more apparent then when Monty and his crew show up covered in all with like little dust clouds, like little pig pens. That it's just so funny to me that they're like, do y'all want to just kind of wash
hang
up
out
real quick?
Yeah, right.
Because I don't
know.
Are they going to have antibiotics for Lucy's UTI that she absolutely has
must
now?
Must have. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm sure. Because she stabs herself with a needle and then she staples herself shut.
Do you think that needle, now that I think about it, was for radiation to deal with that or to deal with her UTI? What do we think was in that syringe?
She just got a quick dose of Cipro.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Because she didn't get up to pee. Anyway.
Who had the time, you know?
Yeah, he was kind of dirty.
That staple scene. I know. Why was that the worst
out I don't
of
know.
All of it?
I don't know. That one, for some reason, wasn't as bad for me as her stabbing herself with the needle.
What?
I have a thing about needles.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I think so that setting is pretty specific. Like the 50s music playing, the bright colors, the cartoonishness.
That move of horrific violence juxtaposed with
I know
and like the
Sopranos,
slow motion
car
it's been
scene.
Done exactly it's been done a million times but oftentimes like it feels out of place because you put that music over a scene where it doesn't make sense but Fallout, that is the music they'd be listening to in a scene like that. You know what I mean? So it just really worked for me here.
They did it more than once. I actually wrote very Sopranos on top of that because we had just watched that scene and commented on it. Just a little side note talking about that setting with the projection. One of the cooler visual effects that I really liked was when the projection starts to kind of melt.
Mm-hmm.
And you see it like projected all around them, that like
practically in the universe, it's just that projector is malfunctioning and melting down. But what you're actually seeing, or but what you're metaphorically seeing then, is that layer melting away and then being introduced to what's actually in the world around them.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
It was very smart. We also meet sort of an antagonist, like besides Monty, who gets drowned in a pickle bin.
It's gonna sting.
That is gonna sting. That's some briny.
He returns with his face all ripped up like a Van.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Stick it in some briny water.
Blech.
I know. But yeah, so we're introduced to Moldaver. I don't know how that's pronounced. I really should. But Sarita Chowdhury, known for many other things, but to me most recently known as Sarah Jessica Parker's new friend in Just Like That. One of the like sort of not to be crass about it, but some of the like people of color that the Sex and the City folks brought in to address the fact that it's like the whitest show in the world.
Right.
And then gave varying levels of actual storylines too. But she is introduced as sort of the leader of this group of raiders.
I'm not familiar with her. I'm looking at her IMDb now. And I thought she was great in the little bit that we got of her.
Yeah, she's a great actor.
But yeah, I just don't know her from anything else. So she's new for me.
She's been in, like, well, I think probably most well-known recently for that Sex and the City reboot.
Mm-hmm.
But
She's done a ton, just nothing.
She's
I've
done
seen.
A ton of work, yeah. She's in the Hunger Games films. She was also a guest star in Rami, that Rami Youssef's show.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and she was in Little Fires Everywhere, which I did watch.
She just is one of those people who she's clearly
shows up in Law and Order, The Good Wife, like Homeland. Oh, she was in Homeland for a while as a main character. That's the other main thing she's known for. She had a decent sized role in that.
Very cool. This cast is so interesting. I really.
Well, can we talk about how I recognized Ben Linus from the computer printer sketch?
I can't believe I didn't. A lot of crossover for things that I love and that we've talked about on this show.
Very
That's the
recently.
Funniest one, because we don't see him.
No, I know, but it is him because he comes up later. But yeah, we saw Kyle MacLachlan and I was like, oh, look, it's Dale Cooper. And then Ben Linus. And also, what's the actor's name that was in? You didn't watch. I almost said Succession. That's not it. Oh, God.
Severance.
Thank you. Did you watch Severance?
I didn't, but is Zach Cherry in it?
Yes.
Yeah, he's great. I love Zach Cherry. He's one of my favorite podcast guests.
He's also great in Severance.
Mm-hmm.
But
I meant to look up, actually, I want to do that now. Who is the casting director for this show? Because they're clearly a comedy fan. Because
actually, I think the part of that is the showrunners.
Okay.
So I don't want to interrupt you with the casting, but there's two showrunners / creators that were brought in by the EPs. One of them is Geneva Robertson-Duare, who had done other adaptations like Tomb Raider, Captain Marvel. The other, Graham Wagner, was a TV comedy writer who was had worked on Baskets, Silicon Valley, and Portlandia.
Oh, okay. So that explains it. That 100%.
Yeah. There's like a real comedy person on this show.
Yeah. And I'm not going to spoil anybody who shows up later, but we've got Zach Cherry, Johnny Pemberton, I thought was a real pull.
Yep.
John Daly, I don't know why, but John Daly is in the credits. Like, I was really impressed with the... man, it's so funny to see podcasts listed in actors' credits.
That's funny.
Because it's like, I'm looking at Johnny Pemberton and it's Fallout, Future Date, Captain Fall, Podcast The Ride, which is a great, great podcast. But it's really cool to see them give kind of equal. And then like these lesser known actors in general, like Aaron Moten and
Zelia Mendez-Jones.
Who have all, like, I'm looking at I'm looking at Aaron Moten's IMDb mm-hmm. now, and it's like he's somebody who's, again, also acted a ton, but not in anything super high profile. Seems like they have a real point of view with how they casted this show, as opposed to just pulling the biggest names that they could, which shows like this, especially for like Amazon, like they could have done that.
Yeah. I mean, this is an incredibly well-funded show. Clearly. Yeah. They literally went to Namibia to film.
Incredible.
Like, so, yeah. But I think what you're getting at and what the lightness we're talking about in the, especially in the vault, mm-hmm. has to do with the fact that the two showrunners come from two very different backgrounds and they're merging those things together.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and one of those is a comedy background mm-hmm. and like a legit one.
Right, right. Yeah, you know? It's really fascinating and it feels really unique, I think, now that you're pointing it out for that reason.
Yeah. Yeah, this does not have a small budget, but they filmed in 2022 in New Jersey, New York, and Utah. Wasteland scenes were additionally filmed in Klumenskop, a former mining operation turned ghost town, as well as on Namibia's infamous Skeleton Coast. So they didn't spare any expenses. So let's stay with set and setting for a minute. Mm-hmm. We talked about the vault. We talked about the opening scenes in LA. Mm-hmm. We should talk a little bit about above ground. What we know so far, anyway, mm-hmm. primarily with the Brotherhood of Steel mm-hmm. and Maximus. And it's quite a shift.
Yes.
Especially visually.
Totally.
Like, we go from bright colors and cartoony outfits, the outfits they wear with the 33 on the back that look like the Rocketeer or like some other sort of, yeah.
They're also blue and yellow.
They are blue and yellow.
Jackets,
like the yellow jackets uniforms, yeah.
Also, like my colors from my middle school. Hate to brag. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Glen Landing, Mighty Lion, Strong, Brave, and True. We are the blue and gold, our dreams we pursue.
yeah, but so we have this big shift in color palette for sure. Mm-hmm. Saturation. Yeah, I could talk about this from a...
They really do make it feel like these could be three different shows altogether. Mm-hmm. Because it would make a sort of sense to carry over, or there's a version where you carry over that color palette, at least to keep it kind of united, you know, across the three, but they don't
do that at all.
And that starkness is, that difference is really stark.
Yeah. No, it's really like when you think of post-nuclear wasteland, mm-hmm. where there's like no green, mm-hmm. everything is brown and gray. Mm-hmm. And like steel blue, mm-hmm. and that's it. I literally in my notes wrote, well, that's a color grading shift. also, I don't know that this might just be the way my weird brain associates, but the barracks that they're in mm-hmm. and the scene with the mountains behind them, it looked mm-hmm. like Manzanar, which was the incarceration site for Japanese American, one of them.
Oh, I mean,
the camps for during World War II. I don't know if that's intentional or not, but it was like, because Manzanar is, I think, in Arizona or California. Yeah, Independence, California. So maybe
even if
that's
not
intentional,
even if it's not, you know,
but like,
death of the author, that's still significant.
Some of the most famous photos from Manzanar are of the barracks with the mountains in the background. And mm-hmm. that scene, that big scene where they show that, I was like, oh my God, that looks like an internment camp.
That's interesting, too, if we're figuring out sort of what the motivations are and how, and like the little we know about Maximus is he feels really dedicated to the cause, whatever his motivations are.
Yeah.
And when he says, like, you gave me a home when I had nowhere to go, I forget what the line is exactly. And it's like, well, that sounds, we've heard the way, you know what I mean? That's like a real recruitment tactic.
Absolutely. But I mean, the world that we're given there is kind of the direct opposite to what we've got in the vault. It's violent. I mean, the mm-hmm. world in the vault got violent, but it's not
but because
naturally
of outside,
violent.
Yeah.
Right. This is violent. It's dusty and dirty and gray and sort of every man for himself. And there's some mysterious, like, ruling party, class, mm-hmm. group, whatever. There's lots of violence amongst the sort of rank and file, you know. There's also a lot of, like, mythological and biblical language, like being anointed, mm-hmm. being a squire, like
calling
all
them
of that
knights
is,
and squires
yeah,
is so
super interesting
and so anachronistic.
Yeah.
It's even for, it's not like, well, in the 50s, that's what we called all our soldiers. So we that just not. Carried over.
Yeah. There's also some really funny visuals that show how grim everything is. Like they're playing basketball with bricks, which really made me laugh.
Uh-huh.
I love they use the phrase no bad ideas in a brainstorm.
Beautiful.
When they're back in the vault. Mm-hmm. But that's like kind of all we get of that part of the world. We see that it's like a power struggle, that some people get like raised up to have more important roles. But everything feels very precarious. So then we pop back to the vault for when Lucy leaves. And she tranks poor... I keep wanting to call him Carl. That's not his name.
Chet.
Her cousin is better.
Oh,
her cousin Chet. I think the other sort of setting that we're introduced to is what it's like right outside the vault when she goes out. Mm-hmm. You know, and we see Santa Monica Pier. We see almost like a Pompeii-like... landscape.
I said the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. With people being like, you know, frozen in their mm-hmm. tracks. Mm-hmm. And then we get them, the other group of idiots, going to get the ghoul, AKA Walton Goggins.
Right. Who and most the most important line in this whole pilot is a feral ghoul can't abide a chicken.
Yeah.
Like yeah. What?
Everyone knows that.
Everybody obviously knows that.
Yeah.
I hope that's like a huge like mechanic in the game, that if you have a chicken, you know what I mean?
The ghoul will go for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I don't know. But yeah, that scene feels very different. Mm-hmm. Apparently the wide shot of that place is Fort Totten Park in Queens. Oh. A lot of this stuff was actually filmed around New York. Cool. Unfortunately, I think, or fortunately for them, unfortunately for the East Coast, the second season, which there is going to be, is going to be shot in California because of tax credits.
Mm-hmm.
So no more Jersey sightings.
Oh, well.
But that's where we leave it. And I think maybe we should talk about questions. Like, what are the questions this has raised for us? Are we interested in them? I mean, it seems like we are, but...
Yeah. I mean, my biggest one... My biggest one right now is less internal and more of how are they going to put these three. I know that they're kind of all headed to the same place, but
right.
I love a party meetup. So yeah. I'm excited to see how they all learn that they'll be better off working together than separate, which is what I'm assuming we're headed toward.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. I guess that's true. Maybe not.
I mean, they all have very different backgrounds, mm-hmm. right? One is a timeless ghoul, one is a army brat of mm-hmm. sorts, and one is a privileged and somewhat naive, probably, young woman.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a little
I love a
eclectic
trio.
Group.
I love a golden trio, and they...
Yeah, no, that's the big one, is like, how are they all going to interact with each other?
Mm-hmm.
I think... For me, part of it is how does she survive? Because right. she's obviously smart and can handle a weapon, but her world
has been very
isolated and very like well provided for. Like the thing that was interesting about seeing a brief glimpse of another vault was like it was decimated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and so not every vault looks like the one they're in. Mm-hmm. Not everyone has had the same benefits, advantages that they've had. And so I think even amongst the sort of privileged underground, they might be more privileged.
Right, right.
You know? And so seeing how she handles herself now that she's out on the wasteland of...
Yeah, you don't get the impression that she's ever had to like go without food, for example.
Exactly.
As opposed to the other vault where...
That was one of my first questions, is how the fuck is she going to eat?
Right, right.
Like, how is she going to find food?
I am... Something that I really like that they did in this episode and that opens up a question then is there's... they could have killed Kyle MacLachlan and then the story is her avenging his death. And I think that's a pretty obvious way to do it. But
I thought they were going to do that. Yeah.
A couple of times. I was like, oh, there he goes. Oh, yeah. There he goes. But instead, the taking of him is really interesting because it's like, well, why didn't they just kill him? Why is it worth it for them to keep him alive? Mm-hmm. Because now they have bait for Lucy. Like,
right.
I don't know that Lucy would have ventured out. Maybe she wouldn't have been driven by revenge. And also, then the second question there is when Moldaver says, like, I'll offer you a choice, them or her. Do they know who they are?
Yeah.
And then we don't get any more information about that, right?
Yeah.
So who are they? What is she pointing to there?
Well, and part of that has to do, I think, with, and I'm trying to not let my actual knowledge interfere with mm-hmm. what I knew watching the show, but is the fact that we know that there are, well, we might not know this, but we have an idea that there's at least like, at least 32 or 33 vaults and probably 100 or more, you know. Right.
Or there were at least.
Right. And so, like, when you say, do they know who they are? It's like, okay, it starts to feel like there's a overarching group of people or plan or something that put all this into place. Because that, mm-hmm. for me, was one of the questions. Is like, so they all live in this vault. Who built the vault? Where'd the vault come from?
Mm-hmm.
Why are there so many of them?
Mm-hmm.
How did they get built? This is not a fallout shelter under someone's house. So I feel like that's, based on the pilot, I think that that's a pretty good summary of where we are and what we're looking towards.
Right. Oh, and then my last question is just like, is this whole first season going to be just Lucy on her way to find her father and the rest of them after this target? And are those things related, or is it going to open up bigger plot points for later seasons?
Right.
Is this even the big, I mean, I have no idea what happens next. I didn't even watch the like upcoming this season, and it's, you know, it's possible that the Lucy trying to find her dad plot point gets solved pretty quickly. I don't know. I doubt it, but it could.
I did watch the upcoming on, and that's how I knew it was Ben Linus. Michael Emerson. He's always Ben Linus.
He's Ben Linus.
But what I would like to take a little bit of time to do, if you will indulge me,
mm-hmm.
is use our Jersey connection moment to talk a little bit about the part of this game that takes place in Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to go into crazy detail or anything, but it's just such, it's so delightful to me that this is a thing that exists. So just to give some brief context, there are a number of versions of this game,
mm-hmm.
right, that came out over the years.
Mm-hmm.
There's like Fallout 2, it goes on and on and on. Anyway, no one cares. Within that is something called Fallout 76, which mm-hmm. was not a super popular part or release for a while.
So yeah,
it's a little
different
than the rest.
What I know about it is it's their world MMO. So it's the one where you can play online with lots of other people. And I think the launch, it was not great. What's cool about those kinds of games in general is they can iterate and they can improve mm-hmm. and they can do that kind of seamlessly, as opposed to having to like, well, we fixed it in the sequel. It's just, and I think that it's become really beloved and they fixed a lot of the problems that people had. And I know there are people like our friend Mike D who are still deep into that game and play all the time.
Right. And so originally it had certain locations.
Mm-hmm.
Appalachia was one of them.
I was gonna say that's the one that's like West Virginia.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. There was Appalachia. There was supposedly like near Pittsburgh was one of the areas you could go to. Yeah. And they then released
mm-hmm.
New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to talk a little bit about what New Jersey is like in mm-hmm. Fallout, because mm-hmm. it's just great. Nothing has made me want to play a video game in the last 20 years except for this.
I don't have a gaming PC and I've been looking.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is the only thing that makes me want to play this game. So New Jersey is broken out into geographical regions
mm-hmm.
in the game. There are a number of factions as well. So the geographical regions are the Chemical Coast, which is the part from like the central Jersey to top of Bergen County, east coast of the state.
Mm-hmm.
There is the Jersey Shore, which is obvious. Mm-hmm. There's the Pine Barrens, which, mm-hmm. yeah. And the, oh, Jesus Christ. We almost got away without having that go off. And then the Skylands, which is the northwest part of the state, mm-hmm. Which are four actual legit regions of the current state.
Yeah, I'm like,
state.
You can kind of, you know, we argue north-south, but maybe we do it this way.
Yeah, because, like, the Chemical Coast, like, if you read the description of it in the game, mm-hmm. it's a region along the shores of Newark Bay, the Arthur Kill, and Raritan Bay. During pre-war times, this stretch of coastline was heavily polluted. Yes. In other podcasts, we have talked about how I grew up near a chromium plating facility, mm-hmm. and one of our dear friends grew up where the Radium Girls were working and had his house, like, encased, like an E.T. house.
Yeah.
So, accurate. It says, heavily polluted due to a concentration of factories and chemical plants, post-war fallout and radiation has only made the environmental issues in the water and nearby coastline worse.
It would be really funny if characters in the game who grew up there, though, were immune to the radiation. That would be really fun.
Yeah. So we'll talk a little bit about stuff. We don't want to go on too long, but I do need to just go over this a little bit. Uh-huh. The Pine Barrens is the next section. And I think I read this to you earlier. The large, heavily forested area stretching much of the southern reaches of the state, the Pine Barrens were largely unspoiled and undisturbed during pre-war days, and very little has changed in the post-war world. This area is home to carnivorous plants, rural backwoods residents known as Pineys, the infamous Jersey Devil, and other kinds of dangers you are.
I'm literally crying. You're just reading about the world. Very seriously now. Did you read anything in there that isn't true about the Pine Barrens right now today in 2024?
No. I did not. And so the last section is the Skylands, which is the mountain. And this, so where I grew up was kind of in between Skylands and the Chemical Coast, mm-hmm. but the mountainous and hilly region running in a northeast to southwest axis in the north. The region starts as low rolling Piedmont hills, roughly 200 feet above sea level, and rises to almost 2000 feet above sea level as the Kittatinny and Shawangunk mountains rise from the ground. Within each section, there are sites and settlements. I'm just going to read some of the names. Mm-hmm. Brick City. Guess where that is.
That's like Newark.
Newark.
Yeah.
Active groups and organizations, Garden State Shipping and the Pulaski Birdmen.
That rules.
It's so fucking good.
Can you just break me off a few of the Pine Barrens ones, please?
In the Pine Barrens, it's really only, it's like one settlement and there are the Pineys.
Again, literal
people
who live there now today.
Yeah.
Self-identifying as Pineys.
Yeah. Do you want me to read a little bit about the Pineys?
I would love for you to.
Okay. Dating back to pre-war times, the Pine Barrens of New Jersey were home to rural families that were considered the dregs of society at the time.
Correct.
Besides for simply being... This is not the most well-written thing in the world. It's a wiki. A fandom wiki. Besides for simply being poor and living underprivileged lives, many of these families contained members that just seemed off. In the early 20th century, Dr. Henry Goddard spent time studying the families of the area, observing their daily lives, and researching their ancestries and origins. I know. The result of his case study were published in a book, The Kallikak Family, A Study in the Heredity of Feeble-Mindedness. This is all real. In it, Goddard determined the decades of interbreeding among Pine Barrens groups that carried feeble-minded genes produced a group of people that were genetically inferior.
This is
so
just
all of this
horrific
is actual history,
right, but literally happened. He's then, wrong. Like, that's not, but that did actually happen.
Yeah. It was eugenics, mm-hmm. period. Mm-hmm. So then we have already insular and self-sufficient. The Great War cut the people of the Pine Barrens off from the rest of society, as it was in the lead up and aftermath of the conflict. Isolated for generations and exposed to the ambient radiation and fallout, the people of the Pine Barrens further mingled among each other, devolving into savage subhuman creatures.
Cool.
From a distance, Pineys resemble normal humans. I know. But upon closer inspection, they look very different. Most are taller and broader than humans, with sinewy bodies raw with strength. Most possess limbs that aren't fully in proportion with each other.
Oh my God.
This is getting very Jersey Devil.
Yeah.
And the rest of the body. They wear tattered clothing, preserving their modesty, but not affording any other real benefit. Pineys are omnivores, though they primarily eat meat, small mm-hmm. game, small reptiles, birds, insects, fish, and deer are their primary food source. Based on the fact that rudimentary piney tools are made of human bones, they likely eat human flesh
Hell
as
yeah.
well. Though whether or not this is considered cannibalism is up to debate.
Oh,
blueberry patches.
They're
wait,
not totally human.
You're going to cry again. Blueberry patches and cranberry bogs are plentiful in the Pine Barrens, and pineys make use of these resources as well. And they, all of these descriptions of these places are based on actual history. So they have pre-war history, and it talks about, like, in the seaside area, it talks about during the colonial days, Barnegat Peninsula was known to be inhabited by privateers and blah, blah. Like, it's the actual history.
It's our literal history.
Yeah. Anyway, I could go on all day about all of this. I like reading about the Pulaski Birdmen. Like, I just, if you're a Jersey nut, like, even if you don't give a shit about video games, because I kind of don't, this was such a fun read.
That's very
and
cool.
I didn't even get through all of it. But, like, literally just the fact that there is a faction that lives on the Pulaski Skyway is just the funniest and most amazing thing.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
I love it.
I love it, too.
And I'll let you guys know if I start
So it
playing.
Sounds like we're both going to eventually... Yeah, please do. It sounds like we're both going to probably continue watching this at some point.
I think I almost
like I said, I have to finish Six Feet Under first.
Right. Again, priorities. Okay, I'm really glad we watched this.
Me too. It's not as grim as some of the other post-apocalyptic stuff. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be grim at times. Obviously, there's a lot of death and murder and stuff. But, like, the tone is more satirical and more funny and more, like...
Yeah, I had fun with it in a way I wouldn't say I've had fun with shows like Silo, for example.
Right, or Last of Us. Yeah. Right. Last of Us, famously not a very
not
cheerful
fun.
Show. No. No. Fun is not the word I would use to describe it. All right. Should we tell everyone what we're watching next week?
I think so.
I'm excited for this one. So this is one I have seen that you haven't. It's come up a number of times recently in relationship to these post-apocalyptic television shows. I feel like it went a little bit under the radar when it came out because it was mid-pandemic. And it's about a pandemic, and a lot of people were like, no, thank you.
Do you know if it got greenlit before the pandemic, or was it like a,
so
do you know?
It is based on the book by Emily St. John Mandel, which came out much before the pandemic. And the show, I believe, was also greenlit and filmed before the pandemic. So it was an unfortunate coincidence that it came out, or fortunate, depending on how you look at it, that it came out when it did.
Should I buy the book? Have you read the book?
I have not read the book. The book is supposed to be very good. We are talking about Station 11.
And
I forgot to say
that. I'll let you guys know how it is.
Okay. The book is supposed to be very good. And so there was a lot of, once again, like a video game adaptation concern about the adaptation of the book. The people that I know that watched this show were extremely moved by it. It is a very different post-apocalyptic show. The pilot doesn't feel as much different as it ends up feeling in the long run. But, you know, the log line is like post-apocalyptic Shakespeare troupe. So if that gives you a sense.
That's like one of those, you know how some shows you put a bunch of things Andrea likes in a bag, shake them up and pull a couple out? That sounds like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I am excited to watch it again. I watched the whole series when it came out week to week, and I haven't watched it since. So I'm happy to revisit.
I'm excited.
Yeah, it is a one season thing because it's based on that book and they are not going to iterate on it as far as I have heard. I've looked a few times to see if they're thinking about doing season two because it did do pretty well, this HBO show. But as far as I have seen, they are not planning on trying to expand on it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And I like that I know very little about it. And I think that'll be fun.
Yeah, it will. Be something. I mean, it's a
maybe not.
It's a mini series about a flu pandemic that wipes out like 90-something% of the population.
Maybe fun isn't the word I'm looking for. I'm coming off of Fallout being fun.
Yeah, this will be an interesting one to talk about because the pilot has to do a lot of setup that then doesn't stay important. Like this is the how it happens partly. Not entirely. There's other stuff that happens. But it's like the first episode. At the time, I remember people saying, if you're triggered by the pandemic part of it all, like the relationship to what's happening right now, that if you get through the first episode, that's kind of left behind. That is our watch for next week. You can find it. It is an HBO show, so it is probably a Max. Yep, it is a Max-owned property. Yes, yeah, so I think you do need to watch it on Max. I could be wrong. You might be able to find it elsewhere, but that's definitely there. And so that is where we will be next week.
I have one little thing to recommend for our Jersey lovers here. And that's if you don't regularly listen to New Jersey is the World, but you are a fan of our Jersey discussions, run, don't walk over to the New Jersey is the World feed, because on Monday we released mine and Chris Gethard's interview with Danny and Kate Tamborelli. Danny Tamborelli is the younger of the Pete and Pete brothers, if you don't know him by name. But he and his wife just wrote a book called Road Trip Rewind that comes out in a couple of weeks. And so they joined us to talk about the book, but of course to talk about his role as Little Pete in a very New Jersey show and his time in New Jersey. And they were lovely. And yeah, go check that out. It's
so cool.
It was like a true like highlight of my life. I never asked. I never asked to do the interviews. And I texted Geth and was like, you have to let me in on this one. Like Pete and Pete was, I talk about the X-Files and Lost, but Pete and Pete was like my first favorite show. So go, and I was normal and cool and not weird at all. So, and it was
I'm
just,
sure you were.
It was just a really fun one. And I think the book they wrote comes out May 21st. So it's got a couple of weeks, but you can pre-order it. And it's really fun. It's like a kind of rom-com that's heavy on the rom and the com, which I like. And very 90s. And one of the characters is from Jersey, though it doesn't take place in Jersey. But you can feel the Jersey in that character for sure.
Can't have everything, I guess.
Exactly. So big time recommend.
Nice.
And where can they find all of the things they need to find?
They can find us at WatchersPodNJ on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And they can email us at WatchersPodNJ@gmail.com. They can find me on Instagram at Jody_Mim. And they can find you
at AQ Andrew AQ.
Yay.
You did it. Where will they see us? Where will we see them?
They're going to see us and we're going to see them in Chicago.
See you in Chicago.